speaking on man and its environment, man-made crisis, and man-made remedies. I'd like to introduce to you the students of Dutchess Community College and our guests, Mr. Ralph Nader, consumer advocate number one.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The subject dealing with the environment is particularly timely given the president's commentary yesterday evening and the general concern over what has been called the energy crisis. And I think that any social problem needs continual definition and redefinition in terms of what people can do about it. And while there's been a great deal written about environmental pollution, if you look back about 6-7 years ago, it focused pretty heavily on trying to prove that pollution was somehow harmful to human health. And we've come a long way since then in terms, I think, of public education of what it's all about. I think there's very little debate now that that pollution is a serious source of many prominent diseases, that it can affect the genetic inheritance in terms of the health of future generations. Whatever questions remain are largely in the area of how serious the situation is, not whether it is a health hazard of some degree of significance. You know, excuse me, it was only a few years ago when pollution was primarily viewed as something that was ugly and dirty. You know, the Pittsburgh pollution was never viewed as a source of respiratory diseases or cancer, except by a few people who were working in the area. It was primarily seen as an aesthetic deprivation rather than as a public health menace. Well, after a few years, the issue shifted into the arena of, do we have the technology to do anything about it? And is there enough money to do anything about it? And it's in this dual arena that the real opportunities for civic action, I think, arise. First of all, if we look at the figures that have come out of the Environmental Quality Council in the White House, we will see that the amount of investment required to dramatically reduce the pollution in the environment over the next 10 years is shockingly little given the size of our economy. The estimate is $270 billion over a 10-year period. That runs to about $27 billion and the average per year. Some of that is direct tax expenditures, such as government support of municipal sewage plant construction. Some of that is industry expenditures. The amount that is industry is taxed off because we have in our tax laws, thanks to industry lawyers and lobbyists, very, very amenable tax write-off systems that reduce the net cost very significantly to the company. Now, if we look at it in terms of a economy that's going to hit at $1.25 trillion this year, and if we look at the $27 billion of expenditure over the average of 10 years, it's nowhere near that now, we can see that we're not exactly throwing this $27 billion away. It is being used to purchase and install equipment, and in so doing, it is supporting a part of our economy that is determined to supply pollution control equipment. It is giving jobs. It is increasing the gross national product. And one can make a list of a lot less useful outlets for the society's investment than pollution control equipment. If you also look at the fact that as this equipment reduces the amount of harmful gases, chemicals, dust levels, radioactivity in the environment, it is reducing the level of expenditure that arises out of job losses and disruptions and wage losses and health and medical expenditures and the like that come about when people get sick because of the disease-bearing environments that they have to work or live in. Another way of putting it is investment in pollution control is the best bargain this society could ever have, both in a short-term and a long-term nature. It also pressures the society to look at its waste. We have a economy that is built on waste. It grows on waste. It even prospers in the short run on waste. And that is partly the reason why we have this problem in the energy area today. Namely, that many of the systems like automobile engines, home furnaces, uninsulated homes, and the way the factories are geared up to consume energy is so wasteful and inefficient that over the years it has boomed the companies that sell oil and gas and coal. And now that for a variety of reasons, some calculated and some not, there is a shortage, a short-term shortage of energy. For those reasons, we now have to say, well, we've got to become more efficient. We've got to develop less fuel consumption for our automobile engines. We've got to insulate our homes. We've got to do something about industry that consumes 70% of the total energy supply in the country in terms of their waste. And that's going to be tough to do because we've got to change a good deal of our technology. You can start with our friendly auto industry in Detroit, who wants to make us believe that the internal combustion engine is eternal, as we are getting to believe it is infernal. And they're not willing to change it. They're willing to put these tack-on devices, pollution control devices, which degrade in effectiveness after a few thousand miles of driving, and which foist a lot of costs onto the consumer in terms of maintenance of these systems. So we're coming down to some very, very fundamental decisions that the public's going to have to either make or not make. And if they don't make them, they're going to pay very, very serious penalties. But first of all, is to develop a clearer perception of the stakes in the pollution fight. The word itself is too charitable, pollution. It's actually a deadly and silent form of cumulative violence that affects present and future generations. It destroys more property in 1 month than all the property destroyed or stolen by street crime in 1 year. It destroys people's health, people's safety. It's even led to automobile crashes by virtue of smog-ridden highways. And indeed, the problem is getting worse because our economy is growing without a commensurate curtailment of the pollution that arises out of the growth of that economy. Now, one of the best ways, in my judgment, to develop the accurate perception of this problem is to bring it down to a neighborhood scale. Now, if you were having a cookout in your backyard and there was a big cauldron of soup being prepared, and Junior walks over to the soup, takes off his shoe, and shakes all the dirt on the soup, like so much pepper. That would be repulsive to people. You just don't pollute your food environment that way. And yet, on a broader and more generalized scale, we are doing far more deadly things to our air, land, and water, which, of course, comes right into the human organism and comes into the food cycle than that young child did in his indiscretion by a long shot. Well, why do we react one way and we don't react the other? One reason is that many people don't feel they have the tools to reach U.S. Steel, Allied Chemical, General Motors, and other corporate polluters who have to be toilet trained over the next decade. Secondly, there's been an explanation of this pollution which is utterly false, and that explanation, which has held sway for almost a century, is that pollution is the price of progress. That if you want plants hiring workers, you got to have pollution. Take your choice. A closed-down plant doesn't pollute. That's the traditional Chamber of Commerce approach in the 50s and the 60s. Well, let's examine that. First of all, what does it cost to curtail pollution in a plant? How does this cost compare with the overall plant revenues every year? And how much of this cost can be written off in taxes anyway? In 1970, the National Industrial Conference Board, which is an industry group, estimated a little less than $3 billion that industry spent on pollution control and installation and purchasing. Now that, of course, compares with almost $80 billion in pre-tax profits of industry that year. Now again, let's reduce it to neighborhood size. If you assume that they spent $3 billion, they wrote off in taxes pretty much half of that. So they're down to about $1.5 billion. Now that's about 2% of their pre-tax profits. Now take a neighborhood example. Let's say you lived next to a landlord that had 25 apartments in an apartment building. He had three workers take care of the apartments and the grounds and the furnace and the like. Every Saturday, he personally went up to the top of the roof of the building and heaved all the garbage on your lawn and sidewalk. After the fourth week of this outrage, you decided to call the police, and the police came, and they said to the landlord, "See here, you're violating a city ordinance. You just can't throw this garbage out on other people's land. And you're going to have to pay to have it carted away like everybody else." The landlord looks at the policeman and says, "My good fellow, you just don't understand the economics of my business. And if you force me to do this, it will cost me $1,000 and reduce the profits from this building by 5 to 10%. And if you insist on enforcing this ordinance, I'll just close down, unemploy my three workers, and move to another community that appreciates my garbage." Now, you see, that wouldn't be tolerated at all. Then why do we tolerate U.S. Steel, or Union Carbide, or International Paper, who pollute to a far, far greater degree with far deadlier gases, chemicals, particulates, and who have, if anything, less reason, because they have more resources, and the proportion of the investment is much less than our little landlord example. One of the important aspects here is for people to appreciate and be sensitive to silent violence. You know how people get very, very nervous about street crime? They will throw a politician out of office who isn't hard on street crime. But how many politicians have they thrown out of office who aren't hard on environmental crime, the kind of crime that doesn't just take your pocketbook or perhaps give you a bump on the head, the kind of crime that may give you cancer, respiratory diseases, or affect your descendants, as well as impair or destroy your property little by little through the corrosion, for example, of these acidic contaminants on your homes and clothing. You know, there's a double standard, even today, that operates. It's a crime for an individual to relieve himself in the Hudson River. It's not a crime for corporations, apparently, to relieve themselves in the Hudson River. Although recently there have been laws passed or discovered, they're not very well enforced. You know, there was an 1899 law that prohibited the industry from dumping contaminants in navigable waterways. It was a crime. And that law was not enforced until 1969 on the first company, even though over 40,000 firms in the United States were violating that law every day. And even today, the law has been suspended for a couple of years, by the way, to give these poor companies a breather. Even today, less than 200 companies were called by the prosecutor in enforcing this law. Now, this is a double standard that should be of concern to us. You know, you go to a primitive society, as they call a primitive society, say some Indian village in the mountains of Mexico, and the worst crime that a citizen of that village can commit is to contaminate the drinking water. Far worse than a so-called street crime in terms of the penalties that are imposed. But because we have, right from kindergarten on up, have been sensitized in and out of school primarily to the more traumatic types of violence, war, arson, burglary, riots. We have not been sensitized to the cumulative type of silent violence such as hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, sulfurs, lead, cadmium, mercury, and so forth. All of these going in huge amounts into our environmental setup. We also seem to think that you can pollute the air, water, and soil, but somehow, you know, the human body is off limits. Somehow our drinking water supply doesn't get polluted. Well, the sooner we understand that basically there is no separation between ourselves and our air, land, and water. There is no separation. We're all part of one cycling cosmic venture, if you will, on an Earth scale. The sooner we will see that an insult to our land, air, or water is inescapably going to be an insult to the human health. I might suggest that you pay some attention. In fact, some students can do some good work here in their science courses to the drinking water supply. Drinking water is going to be, and its contamination, is going to be a major local issue in the 70s. We've sent our scientists around the country, and it's just very, very dismaying what they're coming back with. In New Orleans, for instance, which takes its water from the lower Mississippi, can you imagine? It's like, you know, after it takes all the pollution and waste from the Chicago down, they take their water from it. Their purification systems are largely geared to controlling bacteria. They are not at all geared to detecting and separating out cadmium, mercury, lead, live viruses, and so forth. And Evansville, Indiana is another illustration. Right outside of Boston, the federal government tested the fairly good drinking water supplies for live viruses and found live viruses. The amount of investment in these purification systems is very, very low. And yet, to really dramatically change the situation and clean up 90% of the contaminants that are getting into our drinking water would cost 50 cents per American per year of investment and operating expenses. And you see how little attention is given to our drinking water? I mean, you know, we'll send up a bunch of men to the moon for just one trip will cost as much as the refurbishing of our purification systems for half the country. Our priorities are in inverse. In fact, you should visit some of these purification systems and get some of the materials from the Public Health Service, which will tell you where they think some of the trouble spots are around the country. But a general rule of thumb is that if a municipality gets its water from an originally polluted source, say like the Hudson River or the Great Lakes, that it's largely going to reveal a high risk of heavy metal and other types of contamination that are not screened out. Now, how would you feel if you woke up one morning last June, as the residents of Duluth, Minnesota did, and they found out that they had the highest level of asbestos particles in drinking water ever discovered in the world? And they found that this came from a tailing plant, an iron ore tailing plant that was dumping tons and tons of these iron ore waste, 67,000 tons a day, into Lake Superior, which was the source of the Duluth drinking water supply. And the people in Duluth either quickly moved to bottled water after the health authorities, the health authorities didn't know what to tell the people. You know, on the one hand, they don't want to alarm them. You've heard that one. You know, don't alarm the people, let them drink the poison, you know. On the other hand, they had to tell them something, so they decided to say that all children under 5 should not be allowed to drink the drinking water. And so the parents said, well, I have a 7-year-old, what's the difference? And, you know, the health authorities sort of mumbled, well, if it's really harmful, it's a little late for the 7-year-old, so it doesn't make that much difference. Well, look at the vicious sequence of this, if you will. When your drinking water is contaminated with asbestos particles, these are microscopic particles, you wash your clothes in that water. That means if you hit your pillowcase, microscopic asbestos gets into the air in your home. The plant is throwing up about 6 tons of asbestos particles a day into the air, some miles to the north of Duluth. And it's the only plant that's dumping these tailings into Lake Superior. It could have put them in an open pit type disposal system, but it was easier just to dump them into the lake. And those asbestos particles have now spread throughout Lake Superior, which takes several hundred years to clean itself in terms of natural processes. And what about the fish? It's just no end. And for what? For what? To save a few bucks for an iron ore company? When all the other iron ore companies were dumping it into open pit disposals? What a penalty to pay. For the smallest savings for a few companies, the public is paying deadly penalties and the deadly toll that results from this environmental contamination. How many times have you heard our medical establishment say we've got the best health status in the world? That's utter nonsense. For instance, in adult female life expectancy, there are something on the order of 21 countries ahead of us. For adult male life expectancy, there are about 32 countries. For infant mortality, we're about 14th or 13th in the world, with countries in Eastern Europe ahead of us. And if you look at our general health status, the level of cancer in the last 2 years, particularly in the last recorded year, has jumped dramatically. And if you ask the specialists who work in this area, they're moving more and more to attribute this to environmental causes, as well as some factors in our diet and the use of certain food additives or hormones. And so we simply can't wait, like industry wants us to wait, for people in the thousands to fall on their knees in New York City one day, and as they keel over dead, say in their last words, "It was carbon monoxide, Chevrolet Impalas." If you've got to wait for that kind of evidence, it'll be too late to do anything about it. So we've got to rely on legal, medical, and scientific systems, the scientific to detect, the medical to analyze the impact on health by use of experimental systems, and the legal to foresee and forestall these pollutants by compelling the installation of available or readily available technology to curtail these contaminants. But where does it all start? It starts in terms of our own sense of sensitivity and outrage to the problem. For instance, if you walk down the street in Poughkeepsie, somebody came up, tapped you on the shoulder, said, "Open your mouth." You open your mouth in absolute awe, and they put a little plastic pipe down your mouth through which flows hydrocarbons, nitrogen oxides, and carbon monoxide. Well, you'd be outraged. But you're walking down the street in these cities, and you are being exposed to a compulsory consumption of these contaminants coming out of our automobiles and industries, and there's no outrage. What's the difference? It's purely a matter of abstraction. You've probably studied that in some of your courses. If the immediate source of the injury is anthropomorphic, you know, a mugger in an alley hitting someone, there's an immediate identification and revulsion. But if it's something that comes from machines, from faraway factories, from a more abstract process, then there's a much, much higher level of tolerance and a higher level, obviously, of ignorance about the consequences. Now, suppose there was a high level of radiation in this auditorium. And radiation, as you know, is harmful. Who would know the difference unless you had a Geiger counter? It's a form of silent violence you can't see, smell, taste, or hear. And yet it's registering its impact. You don't pick up a glass of water in the morning and hold it up to the window and say, "Ah, cadmium level's up today." You can't smell, see, taste, or feel cadmium in the drinking water. And so many of these chemicals and gases and particulates do not immediately produce pain or anguish on the part of the receiver or consumer of these contaminants. And so it's easy to defer attention to it and just to shrug it off and go about one's business. Well, unless we develop that kind of sensitivity, both to these contaminants in our own bodies and the contaminants into the natural environment, we are not going to develop the civic action and the power to get this job done. You know, it's not particularly edifying to say to the younger generation, "Young people of America, Your greatest challenge is to, in effect, curb the waste disposal practices of industry in their plants and in their products, and to change the habits of consumers so that they have more ecological sensitivity. I mean, there are a lot of other things in life, you know, that one would like to spend one's time at than, in effect, trying to curb these wastes. But unfortunately, that is going to be a challenge. And the sooner we meet it, the faster we'll overcome it. And there's no question that we could virtually wipe out air and water pollution in 10 years if we really wanted to as a nation. If we had the same determination as we had getting to the moon, we could do it. We've got the technology. It's a highly economic investment in pure dollar terms for the economy, as well as in pure prevention of health and safety hazards. Now, how do we go about doing it? The first is to make a personal decision in terms of changing one's habits. Now, I don't go for the strategy that says, look, pollution control starts at home, and people should pick up the little trash outside their homes, and they should not have disposable bottles and cans and the like, and they should recycle their newspapers. That is a drop in the bucket. But it is very important for another reason. That is, if people begin changing their own personal habits and become more thrift, or that's the old word for ecology, thrift-minded, recycling, changing these habits, they'll begin to steel themselves for the kind of determination that they're going to have to project toward the industries that are by far the principal source of the problem. Not only do they produce directly most of the pollution, but they produce the kinds of goods that pretty much give the consumer little choice. I mean, it would be nice to jump into a car that gets 35 miles on a gallon, wouldn't it? But it's pretty hard to do that. And the only way you can get close to that is to trade off on the safety of the car by getting a little car, which is far less safe in a collision than a larger car. But the average mile per gallon now in the United States four-door sedans is less than 13 miles per gallon. And so you can say, well, I want to walk a little more, and I don't want to go over 50 miles per hour, and I want to do everything that President Nixon has told us to do, because he's doing the same thing in the White House. You can say all that, but the fact of the matter is that if you were given a car with a 35 miles per gallon efficiency level, that would make a far, far greater difference. And if the highway lobby years ago would have gotten off the backs of some very far-sighted planners who want to develop mass transit systems, you would have an alternative for some of your travel in terms of mass transit systems. So that industry sets the parameters, so to speak, of technological choice, and there is where the focus has to be intensified. Now, the headlines of the day are focusing on the so-called energy crisis. And as is usual, when the stakes are high for corporations, the issues are clarified only for corporate vested interest purposes and not for the consumer purposes. If we start back in 1972, early 72, we start with an oil industry that for every year has pretty accurately calculated the increase in demand for home fuel, oil, and gasoline, and has met that demand. However the price mechanism may be for it, they at least met the supply. Now, for a period of years, a number of things had piled up on the oil companies' desks that they wanted desperately. They wanted offshore drilling in the Atlantic coast. They wanted the Alaska pipeline. They wanted to drive out the independent refineries and gasoline stations. They wanted lower pollution standards. They wanted more tax credits. And above all, they wanted higher prices. Now, how do you get all these things? I mean, even for the oil industry, such avarice is stupendous. How do you get all these things? Well, the way you get them, and I'm speaking now about the 20 major oil companies, Exxon, Shell, Arco, those kind, Texaco. You get them by a daring strategy. And the daring strategy is to lead the country into a short-term energy shortage scare. Now, all the oil companies had to do, as Dave Freeman of the Ford Foundation Energy Study put it, in 1972 to alleviate the fuel shortage in this country was to have asked the president to lift the oil import quota. The oil import quota was imposed in 1959 at the behest of the oil companies in order to keep the price of domestic fuel high. And President Nixon's task force on the oil import quota, which registered its report in early 1970, estimated that the quota, by reducing competition, in effect, cost American consumers $5 to $7 billion a year. Now, if you went down to your local gas station, and after charging you per gallon of gas, the retailer said to you, by the way, another nickel for every gallon, you'd say, what for? He says, it's the oil import quota. We got to collect it at the grassroots level. Well, you know how long, there'd be a lot of consumer resistance. But when it's done on a more abstract basis by signing an executive order, then most people don't even know why gasoline costs a nickel more a gallon because of the import quota. Well, they didn't ask the president to lift the quota. He finally did in the late spring of this year. But then by then it was getting to be quite late, and then you had the war in the Middle East and different complications. But the oil industry has served its strategy well, because here's what's happened. They have gotten higher prices, and they've recorded the highest profits in their history. They have gotten the Alaska pipeline on their terms, that is, on terms that some people think are dangerous from an ecological point of view and from the possible risk of tanker spills that would destroy part of Alaska's fishery resources. They have gotten a proposal from Mr. Nixon to the Congress for an added investment tax credit. They have squeezed some retailers out of business who used to give them price competition. They are now on the verge of getting lower pollution standards, as you heard last night. And they are increasing the likelihood that they will start drilling off the Atlantic coast without the kind of adequate public participation to ensure the safety of such drilling. That's not bad for the oil industry's point of view. They also gambled, though, and they got in return some state attorney general investigations, as well as the FTC case trying to break up the oil industry into more competitive restructuring. Okay. But they've had these before, and they'll probably ride out this kind of investigation. In the meantime, they're getting what they wanted. Now, what kind of energy policy must consumers push for? I think two kinds of energy policies and two kinds of substantive approaches. One is a short term. The short term has got to be the following, over, say, a 15-year period. We've got to rely on fossil fuels. There's no way around it. But we can do it by having stronger pollution controls installed. These pollution controls are available. We can also do it by demanding more deep underground recovery of coal. 94% of the coal reserves in the United States are not strip mine coal. They're deep underground coal. And the equipment there for developing safe extractive measures with a high level of automation are surprisingly available. There's also a important strategy of energy conservation. We waste enormous amounts of energy. In fact, the Oil Office of Energy Conservation in the Department of Interior is willing to support the following proposition. The United States wastes 40% of its energy. That is, it could run its economy with a 40% saving if it followed a number of practices. A number of them in industry, which need not be gone into now, but in terms of residential and personal transportation, the mere insulating of houses would save many, many, many millions of dollars a week of fuel consumption. The home furnace that you have in your home could be designed in a more efficient way. There is waste all the way from the piping of gas to the leakage of gas under our cities, to the way it's converted into usable heat in our homes. There's massive overlighting. You ever been in some of these new office buildings? Their new lighting pushes it up to about 120 foot candles, when about 30 foot candles are more than sufficient, according to ophthalmologists, who are now getting worried that there is so much lighting that it may begin to harm the visual acuity. That's another area of waste. You've heard about the motels and a kind of Kafkaesque pirouette. You go into a motel room in the summer, and the air conditioning is on so high that they supply you with an electric blanket. The over-illumination, of course, increases the heat in the building. It puts a greater stress on the air conditioning systems, which absorb more electricity, which, of course, requires more burning of coal, and on we go. Energy conservation, then, is something which can be done in the home, can be done, for example, in our use of the automobile, but it also has to be done most significantly in industry, which wastes energy as if there's no tomorrow. One of the reasons why they waste energy is because the pricing system does not penalize that kind of waste. The big users of electricity pay less per unit than you do in your homes, and that's the way it's been priced. The more you use, the less you pay per unit. And if it's done in reverse, that is, the more you use, the more you pay, you'll get a stronger resistance to waste on the part of industrial commercial enterprises and an energy conservation output as a result. One of the most important dimensions of the energy policy is, what do we do after 15 or 20 years? Well, the conventional answer is, we know what we're going to do. We're going to build nuclear fission plants. There are 36 operating in the United States today, and they're providing 5% of the electricity, and the government hopes to get these plants built up to a level of 1,000 such plants by the year 2000. Well, let me make a prediction, if you will. If we have a 1,000 nuclear fission plants by the year 2000, you can say goodbye to the United States of America. If you have just 3 or 4 major accidents in these nuclear fission plants, you have the most catastrophic disaster that this country has ever undertaken, including the Civil War. Let me explain. The average nuclear fission plant has more radioactive mass than 1,500 Hiroshima-type weapons. That's what's in that reactor core surrounded by that pretty little dome of that nuclear plant near your neighborhood. So what that means is that there must never be a rupture of that core. There must never be a release of radioactive gases. There must never be any sabotage, any theft of radioactive materials, any disruption of the waste disposal depots where these hot radioactive wastes, which are lethal for tens of thousands of years, are disposed. There must be no hijacking of trucks for any kind of nuclear blackmail that carry these radioactive materials. There must be no earthquakes. There must be no other acts of God, as they're called. In short, we have a technology that is developing in our country, which must be perfect forever, or the alternative is disaster to hundreds of thousands of people and future generations. Now, for years, the Atomic Energy Commission, which licenses these plants and which took $30 billion of the taxpayers' money to develop nuclear energy, which was then given to Consolidated Edison and other utilities around the country, for years, the Atomic Energy Commission would not tell the public the facts. For years, inside the Atomic Energy Commission, they felt that these plants produce electricity, and although they have certain risks, science and technology will catch up and fix these risks. Okay. In short, they went in an imbalanced way. Once they found that the plant gives benefits, electricity, they licensed them, but they forgot about the risks, or at least they didn't do enough about them when they licensed them. And they also did another thing that was very, very serious compared to other countries. They sited these plants near major metropolitan areas, like 30 miles from Washington. In England, they put these plants up in very remote areas for good reason. Because if you had a major meltdown accident in a nuclear power plant, that is, if the water cooling system failed and the heat of the radioactive mass was not cooled, it melts down anything known to man. I mean, there's nothing that can stop this meltdown. Steel, concrete, you name it. It goes through everything. And if it releases these radioactive gases, here is the possible disaster level according to a suppressed Atomic Energy Commission study of 1965, which was just released a few weeks ago. 45,000 deaths, hundreds of thousands of injuries from radiation contamination, damage to future generations, genetic effect damage, and $17 billion worth of property damage, and an area the size of Pennsylvania contaminated. That is, a meltdown accident, if it was on the shores of Lake Michigan, you couldn't use the waters of Lake Michigan for over 100 years. Now, there's one industry that knows how unsafe nuclear power is. It's the insurance industry. They won't insure it. So the government, in order to protect the utilities, passed a law in 1957 saying that no claims totaling more than $500 million would be acknowledged, and that the government would indemnify the people damaged up to that level. Well, if the property damage alone is $17 billion, what about the other $16,500,000,000? If the utility companies had to pay the going rate for insurance for these nuclear power plants, they could never operate these power plants because they couldn't pay the going rate for insurance. Instead, the government comes in, indemnifies up to the $500 million level, subsidizes the industry, prohibits any claims above the $500 million level, and makes it artificially economic to operate these plants. Now, all over the country, the most incredible things are happening. There's a plant in Virginia, 95% finished, when they found out that it was over an earthquake fault. And it turns out that two community college professors discovered this in 1970, and the company didn't want to make it public, and they want to continue building the plant. In Richland, Washington, where these hot radioactive wastes are disposed, 125,000 gallons leaked from the bottom of one of the tanks, and the government found out about it over a week later. And then they couldn't tell the scientists at MIT whether the ground was permeable or non-permeable in terms of what the risks are of this getting into the drinking water level, into the water tables, and eventually to the drinking water.